tell me what's happening, what's the buzz? Tell me what's happening, what's the buzz? Tell me what's happening, what's the buzz?
Well, the Seattle police chief is shocked. The police union is offended. Are we vilifying our police when they clash with protesters? Welcome to Friday. This is KUOW's Week in Review, where we discuss, debate, analyze, learn from the week's top stories. I'm Bill Radke, today with Todd Myers, director of the Center for the Environment at the Free Market Washington Policy Center. Welcome, Todd.
Thanks for having me.
Knute Berger is the Mossback at Crosscut.com and a Seattle Mag columnist. Hey, Knute.
Hey, Bill.
Erica Barnett covers the City Beat at TheCIsForCrank.com. Welcome back, Erica.
Thank you.
You can tweet us right now. We're live tweeting at KUOW, and we're on Facebook, of course, KUOW Public Radio. Who do you blame for Seattle's May Day unruliness? And did a city council member go too far in blaming Seattle police? Councilmember Bruce Harrell, chair of the Public Safety Committee, by the way, reacted to video of a police officer riding his bike into a group of protesters, tackling one of them. Harrell called that move a little idiotic. And he said that seemed, quote, like the first act of violence, the first act of unfairness. It seems like that created the melee. Police Chief Kathleen O'Toole says she was shocked and disappointed to hear Harrell's comments. The police union said it's outraged. Quote, Harrell insinuated that the actions of Seattle police officers caused the riot on May Day. This morning, I asked Bruce Harrell if he wants to take back anything he said.
No, I don't mean to upset anyone, but I asked some very direct questions that I think any reasonable person would ask when looking at the video. But I'd also given the department a day's notice that I wanted them to explain the events that precipitated the video. I've historically always praised both our chief and the police department for what they do. But I have to ask a tough question, because after the bicycle ran into the protesters, it seemed like all the melee occurred, and I gave them the opportunity to really shine and really talk about why they did what they did. I don't think the command staff responded to the question adequately, and I think the public really deserves the right to know.
So you were just asking questions. You also stated, it seems like that created the melee. Do you still stand by that?
Well, I think that's an accurate assessment. So certainly I stand behind the inquiry. I think too much emphasis is put on maybe how I asked the question, but more emphasis should be placed on the question, is that the best way to make an arrest from behind when we have an officer on the bike? Is that consistent with our training? And if we're going to keep the stench of what we see in other cities here in Staten Island, in South Carolina, keep that stench outside of the city of Seattle, where we don't want that here, we must ask the tough questions. And quite frankly, they were giving these very terse responses that were inadequate.
So you don't think this is just an officer who in the moment made a bad decision, but you think this was you're faulting Seattle police policy on May Day?
That was the question. That was simply the question. When you look at the video, it looked like the officer decided to gain momentum, pump the pedals, and run into the protesters. So I'm sure that was strategic. Then you saw a couple of more officers follow in suit, and then all the melee occurred. So my question was, is this a recommended approach given that situation? And again, the police department suggested that they had probable cause to arrest one person, and then after they arrested that one person, all of the melee occurred. So I asked the question, why wouldn't they surveil that one person if they had probable cause? He was not fleeing at that point, so he didn't look like a risk of flight. I was told after my inquiry that they had a line of vision on the person, and they couldn't see the person outside of certain lighting conditions, and so it was the moment to strike, if you will. They failed to say that at the hearing, and that is exactly the kind of response that we have to have publicly, such that the public gains some trust in our department, and that's the discussion we have to have.
Some people say you highlighted police misconduct because it'll get you votes for re-election. What do you say?
I say that's absurd, and you know, and everyone knows my style is very candid. I've repeatedly and historically praised both the chief and the officers for the fine job that they do, and I will continue to do that, but I will not back away from these kinds of questions. So I think those kinds of criticisms that something was politically based are just ill-placed.
So that was Seattle City Council member Bruce Harrell, chair of the Public Safety Committee. As I said, the police union said they were outraged and offended. They responded with a version of what happened before that bicycle incident, with demonstrators grabbing a police bicycle, breaking a hole in a window, throwing a chair at officers, pelting officers with bottles, rocks, slingshots, barricades. The question is, are we vilifying our Seattle police when it comes to how they handle demonstrators? Or do the police deserve critiques like the one Bruce Harrell just gave? Erica?
Well, I think absolutely we should be critiquing our police department. And I think that Bruce tends to speak, as he said, in a very, he put it, candid way. He's a little off the cuff. And I think that the police chief's outrage is misplaced around the specific words that he used. But his point that, you know, we should be looking at things like police officers riding their bikes directly into a line of protesters is a good one. And it does look from that video as if the police acted a little bit too aggressively.
But to say cause the melee, I just listed some of the things that demonstrators did before that ever happened. Is that fair?
Well, sure. I'm not going to exonerate the demonstrators for what they were doing. But I think it speaks to the fact that, you know, we need a bigger picture of what actually happened there. Looking at the video again, it looks one way, and perhaps looking from the ground, it looks another way. If the police are not willing to, as Bruce Harrell said, answer that question and explain their justification in more detail, then I think that's a perfectly legitimate question to raise.
Todd Myers, you agree?
Well, he said that he didn't want to take away from the question of, is this consistent with police training? And he didn't ask that question at the council. That's not what he said. What he said was, well, this looks idiotic to me. So how do you, and then later when he does your interview, oh, I was just trying to say, is this consistent with your training? Is this, well, those are questions that he never asked at the council meeting. And so he's surprised when he says, well, gee, you guys are acting idiotically and caused the melee. And then he's surprised he gets terse answers. That's not how you do an honest investigation. That's not an interest in finding out, okay, is this the best way to do it? He can get those answers, and I agree with Erica. Great. Ask those questions. You don't want police doing things that exacerbate a problem, but you don't know the context of it. And I would think by now, in the age of the internet, saying, hey, I saw a video on the internet, looks like you caused this, is probably not a very good ground to stand on.
Canute, our police are frustrated. They're under this order from the Justice Department to clean up their act, excessive use of force, biased policing. Are we over-vilifying the people who we ask to protect and serve and keep the peace in tough situations?
Well, I don't think for the most part they're over-vilified. I mean, the new administration, we've cleaned house. They're in compliance so far with the Justice Department demands to remake the department. They're making efforts. And, you know, police in these situations are always in a very difficult thing. You have a lot of protesters are there to protest. And then you have usually in these kinds of protests, you have a small black clad, anarchist group. And those guys are generally there ready to make trouble of some kind. And they want to induce the police into overreacting because that is part of their politics. And so the police have to protect civilians and protect property and that kind of thing. But they also have to be careful in terms of how they respond so that they don't accelerate the situation. And I agree with Todd. I mean, just totally looking at the video, yeah, I couldn't see what happened there is idiotic, except that once this guy was down on the ground, the police were attacked by anarchists around them throwing things and, you know, getting into the tussle. So it wasn't like, the procedures for how you de-accelerate, you know, a situation.
De-escalation.
De-escalation. Thank you. it's clear that those tactics need to be employed, but it's also always going to end up with a mixed answer at the end when you have a situation where people are trying to provoke this very kind of reaction.
So, Erica, as Knut's saying, this stuff happens in the moment. Is it? I come back to you. Is it not unfair to talk about causing the melee and being idiotic when this stuff happens in real time? Nobody knows what's happening out of their field of vision. what's going to happen next?
Well, these things always happen in real time, and that's why you have police training for how to react in real time. Of course, you know, on the ground, it looks one way, and from the air, as this video is taken, it looks a different way. But the fact is that police need to know how to react appropriately, and it's totally fine to ask questions about whether they did so. I don't go to the melee.
That's appropriate. That's right.
You guys going to the melee this weekend? I'm going to skip it.
I don't go to the May Day protests anymore. I used to go occasionally to cover them. And 2 years ago, I got pepper sprayed in the face by an officer at about 2 feet away for trying to take a photograph. And I talked to another reporter. The same thing happened too. And it did seem at that point fairly indiscriminate. So that's only a couple of years ago. And so I think that extra scrutiny on the police is completely appropriate, you know, when you've had these incidents in the past, and the question is whether they have responded and are acting more appropriately now.
So what happens next? The police department is reviewing its tactics, and they'll come out with a fuller report from Police Chief O'Toole?
That's my understanding, and hopefully that report will not simply say they acted completely appropriately, and end of story. If they did act completely appropriately, I think it would be nice to know how and why.
And I think Bruce is laying down a kind of new rule, which is the level of scrutiny is ratcheted up. In other words, that now that we're in this new regime and you have changes taking place, we're going to watch like a hawk to see that this stuff is checked out, that you have good answers, and that it works. And I don't think we're at a point where we can just take it on trust.
I think that's fine. How many protesters were sent to the hospital?
I don't know that.
I know three police officers were sent to the hospital.
I believe it was around a dozen.
So, it's not like, I think you need to focus on the fact that there were three police officers that were sent to the hospital. So this is it's a difficult job. They are facing physical threats. And if you're asking them to do that difficult job, I think it's appropriate to do the scrutiny and things like that. But I also think you have to understand the situation they're in. And like I said, this sort of off the cuff, I saw a video and therefore I'm drawing a conclusion, is just not a proper way to do that sort of analysis.
We'll watch the Seattle police report like a hawk and let you know here on KUOW. Given that there are melees and bad actors walking around, would you let your child walk home alone, go outside and play and just be home by dark? We're going to talk about free-range parenting in about 20 minutes on KUOW's Week in Review. On an improbably gorgeous Friday, you're with KUOW's Week in Review. Todd Myers directs the Center for the Environment at the Free Market Washington Policy Center. We're with the Mossback at Crosscut, Knute Berger, and Erica Barnett covering the city beat at the CisForCrank.com. And we are discussing the top stories of this week, including that Shell Oil Arctic drilling rig headed to Elliott Bay, the flotilla of kayaktivists ready to block it. All of that is on hold now. Seattle's mayor says he opposes the drilling, and the Port of Seattle doesn't have the right permit for it. Shell Oil says whether Seattle hosts its Arctic drilling fleet or not, it will bore those new wells this summer. Quote, "There are other ports that would like us to be there," said a Shell exec, and they continue to be supportive. So if Shell takes its business to another port and drills anyway, and Seattle loses hundreds of jobs, did the mayor's office accomplish anything this week, Todd?
No. But that's how we do environmental policy, which is that we do symbolic gestures, because the goal so often is sort of this public display of piety rather than things that are actually effective.
What's wrong with symbolism?
Well, symbolism is fine as long as you eventually accomplish something. We don't ever accomplish anything in this town. You know, when Greg Nickels was mayor, he had the city sign the U.S. Conference of Mayors Climate Protection Agreement, where he promised to meet the Kyoto targets by 2012. And instead of emissions going down, emissions went up in Seattle. So, symbolism is fine, but at some point you actually have to accomplish something, and this is not, right? We're going to see this drilling rig go elsewhere. So are they going to stop? Are they going to achieve the goal of reducing greenhouse gas emissions? No. So there's lots of things you can do. They're spending lots of time and money to do something that won't actually achieve the goal. You could spend some time and money doing something that actually achieved the goal. Why not do that?
Erica, is this pointless? Seattle might at least delay this rig coming into town. Is this pointless?
Well, I don't think it's pointless. And I do think that in this case, symbolism is a good thing if you believe that Arctic drilling is a bad thing and that global warming is real and that climate change is something we need to deal with in this generation. Because, yes, the city council cannot and the mayor cannot stop global warming. They cannot stop even Arctic drilling for this one rig. That is absolutely true. But symbolism is what gets things gets movements happening. And in this case, you know, the movement against global warming is going to happen because in part because cities and individuals say, we don't want this. We don't want to be the place that welcomed Shell Oil and it effectively endorsed Arctic drilling by saying, yes, please dock here. And, you know, I would dispute that there are hundreds of jobs at risk here from having Shell moor its own fleet here.
That's a Port of Seattle estimate.
Yes, yeah. And the Port of Seattle has an interest in making that estimate. Right. And to the point of symbolism, we adopted a higher minimum wage. That is beyond symbolic, true, but it's also symbolic to the rest of the country, which is now moving in the same direction. We have made statements endorsing gender equality in pay, and there's not a whole lot the city can actually do about that or has done, but it starts us on a path, and that's an important thing that the city can do, being a city.
Todd, do you deny that symbolism starts movements?
Well, I think that you can – arguing your position is a fine thing to do. But I was about a month ago, I participated in a panel on climate change at the UW, and I asked how many people believe climate change is serious. And most people raised their hand. And I said, okay, if you believe it's serious, then you also have to be serious about accomplishing the goal. You can't say, oh, I believe it's a serious problem. Let's go start a drum circle. Right. You have to make the policies equivalent to the challenge.
How is standing up against this Arctic oil drilling rig just starting a drum circle?
Because the Arctic rig is going to go somewhere else and it's still going to drill. You're not. If the goal is to reduce Arctic drilling, this does nothing. There are lots of things that you can do that may not address Arctic drilling, but reduce carbon emissions, right? There's things we can do in the city.
But how about those measures and symbolism at the same time? Why are these mutually exclusive?
But we're not doing those other measures. That's the point is that we're...
So you're calling for more action against climate change.
I'm calling for us to spend our time on things that matter. We don't spend our time on things that matter, right? Seattle's emissions went up, not down. Because we focused, because we spent all of our time making ourselves feel good, doing symbolic gestures, and then we went, well, I'm good, and we wiped our hands. That's what this is. This encourages that sort of simplistic, ineffective approach, which is more symbolism.
Knut, simplistic, ineffective?
Well, I think, let me just talk about it from a raw political standpoint, which is Murray is probably doing the Arctic oil business a favor by if they were actually able to prevent them from coming here and they went to, you know, Everett or wherever else they might go. It's going to be further away from the intense kind of media and activist scrutiny they would get here. In other words, some people have criticized the port decision by basically for the same reasons that people criticized the World Trade Organization for being invited to Seattle, also by port people, which was Seattle appears to be a free trade city, but it's also a city with a great history of protest and tolerance of protests. And it's very difficult to mount a global media event from some remote island in the Aleutians. It's very easy when you're in a place like Seattle.
So you think allowing this drig right on through
the port was warned about this before they made the decision, which is Seattle is you're going to regret this because of the kind of backlash that is going to come about. And the fact that Greenpeace, instead of being out in boats somewhere in the Chukchi Sea, are going to be right here in Elliott Bay. So I think in some sense, the politics of it is one, Murray knows that the majority of voters in Seattle, I believe, would support keeping Shell out. And two, if there are problems that result, those kind of fall in his lap, see May Day. And but he is transferring the accountability to the port. He's putting it on the port. He's putting pressure on the elected officials at the port to revisit their decision or regret their decision.
So he's happy with a delay, and the port gets blamed for WTO-like protests in Seattle?
Yes. Yeah. If it comes to that.
If it comes to that. The Seattle Times editorialized that this move could permanently tarnish, I'm talking about the mayor's office delaying this oil rig's arrival. This move could permanently tarnish the reputation of Seattle's struggling port and put the city's future as a maritime hub in question. So however many jobs are jeopardized now, Erica, would you agree that this says, close for business. We have a meddlesome mayor. Take your business, your family wage jobs elsewhere.
Well, that is a ridiculous claim by the Seattle Times. And I think one that, you know, if they look back in 40 years, if newspapers still exist, and see this editorial where it also says it ends with how much of Seattle's role in global commerce should be subject to city politicking. Suggesting that our role in global commerce is somehow threatened as a city with the history that we have as a port city by this one gesture by activists to try to stop this. I think that will look ridiculous when we have either been, you know, really decimated by global warming or have finally decided to deal with it. And I think just the notion that we're going to be closed for business is a very common one that is brought up every time a progressive change is suggested. See, again, the $15 an hour movement where the Seattle Times and others who opposed it were saying, actually, I don't know if the Seattle Times eventually opposed it, but the Seattle Times did say at the time that it will be saying that we are closed for business. And look around. We're very much open for business.
I'll give a free marketer Todd Myers the last word. She just said you're on the wrong side of history, sir.
I don't know. That's what she said, but I'm more than comfortable with my position in history. But I think, that brought up the WTO. That was a very symbolic gesture, right? The WTO riots that we had here. Is the WTO any different today than they were in 1999? No. That was a hell of a symbolic gesture, and it made absolutely no difference. If we care about reducing climate change, reducing carbon emissions, do things that matter.
And I have to get a response there. Made no WTO. Would you agree, Erica and Knut? No, made no difference.
No, I do think it made an important and symbolic difference. I mean, you can argue over the substance. We're still the U.S. is still engaged in approving free trade agreements and that kind of thing. So it didn't. But okay. In that sense. But I think it made people look at the issue much more carefully. And I think that's important.
And Todd is smiling because he's saying, when does symbolism eventually lead to some change? Yes, Erica, last word.
I think eventual change is a perfectly fine goal. And to say that this must either stop global warming or not go on at all, or represent some big step in that direction.
Or even a tiny one.
Well, it's not. I would say it's more than a tiny one, but it is small, and things start small.
The Port of Seattle is meeting to figure out what to do next. Royal Dutch Shell says, as of now, it's still planning to pull the Polar Pioneer into Elliott Bay and more at Terminal 5. So we'll see whether it arrives and whether kayaktivists float to block it. This is KUOW's Week in Review. The Seahawks' top draft pick is accused of domestic violence. Do you want your home team to be zero tolerance, or do we all deserve a second chance? That's coming up in about 20 minutes on the Week in Review on KUOW. Continuing on with the week's top stories on KUOW Seattle. This week, the Seattle Education Association, the teachers' union, announced it will join dozens of other local teachers' unions across the state in a rolling one-day strike. Seattle teachers will skip school on Tuesday, May 19th, to protest how the legislature is shortchanging public education. Seattle schools will close. Make your child care plans. Statewide, these strikes will affect 1 out of every 4 students in state public schools, it is estimated. Should the teachers' union's complaints be drawing kids and parents into their battle, Knut?
Well, when I first heard about this, I was regretting that teachers' unions or teachers didn't do this when I was in school.
It might be a lovely day on Tuesday.
I felt the same about school the same way that Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn felt about school. So it would have been greeted. I'm not sure parents will greet it because schools are largely treated as daycares for working parents. So it creates an inconvenience for some people that they might regret. But I think that
you don't think this even wins
this
them
is,
friends.
This is going to Todd won't like this because it's a symbolic gesture. It doesn't solve the real problem. But I think raising the issue statewide through an act like this that raises the issue from the union's perspective about how teachers are being treated, how the education system those problems are not being solved at the state level. I think it's a fine symbolic statement.
What about that symbolic gesture, Todd?
Well, I think if you said to the teachers union, hey, we made a symbolic gesture, now will you go back to work? I don't think they'd be very happy with that. My sister is a special ed teacher, and so I certainly understand the challenges that teachers face, and I have a lot of sympathy for them. But I think that this is, what I'm frustrated about this is that I don't think this is about the kids. I don't think this is about helping the kids, helping improve the classroom. I think this is about sort of payroll issues, right? My favorite quote in all of this was from one of the teachers union people who said, we haven't had a pay raise. We've had a COLA, which is not a pay raise. It's like, well, tell people that you're getting a COLA is not a pay raise. And so I think that they play silly games like that that have lost sight of the reality. And the other issue is just fundamental. They sign a contract. They demand that the school district live up to that contract. Well, their contract says that they won't walk out, and yet they are. So I just think there's a lot of political game playing on this.
I didn't realize that. Is this explicitly a violation of their contract to do this one-day strike?
In some school districts, they have a specific – it is illegal for them to strike statewide, but there are also school districts that have specific clauses in the contract, and some of those school districts have teachers walking off the job.
Well, cost of living raises is on the list that I've seen, but of course we also have – the Supreme Court, state Supreme Court, saying the legislature is underfunding education. Voters passed this initiative saying reduce class sizes, and the legislature is resisting that. So is silly really the word, Erica, for this teachers' union walkout?
I don't think it's silly at all. And it's just to Knut's point, I actually did get some days off from school when I was a kid. And so I am very much in favor of teacher strikes. My childhood self is, anyway.
Young Erica singing Solidarity Forever.
Exactly. So, but as far as it being silly and a mere payroll issue, just to speak to that point, I don't think payroll for teachers is a silly issue, because the quality of teachers declines when people are leaving these jobs that are very poorly paying for more remunerative ones. And
are they leaving the jobs?
I don't have my computer here to tell you the exact stats, but I would certainly imagine that at the level they're being paid in the 40s and 50s for very skilled work and very, tiresome and difficult work, I would leave that job. Let me just speak for myself. I would certainly, especially if I hadn't gotten a raise in 6 years. And I'm sorry, your other question was, about McCleary.
This is the state Supreme Court ruling that the legislature is underfunding education.
Yeah, and that's absolutely something that the legislature needs to address. And 1351, which mandated higher class, but smaller class sizes.
That's the initiative that state voters passed.
Correct. Whether you like it or not, it's the law of the land, and the legislature needs to figure out a way to deal with it. Right now, they're only dealing with K-3 education, which is a far cry from K-12. And so this may be a symbolic gesture, but it's a symbolic gesture saying, you need to follow the law, legislature, and give us raises that were mandated, COLAs, and comply with Initiative 1351.
And just to be absolutely clear, you're saying that all those grievances rise to the level of forcing parents to get childcare, et cetera, walking out of school for a day, okay with you?
It is, yeah. I think it's a symbolic gesture that doesn't impact, you know, more than one day of anybody's life.
The legislature can turn anything into a symbolic gesture. As Erica rightly points out, the initiative was passed. Democrats and Republicans, for the most part, hate the initiative. They don't want to implement it. They certainly don't want to implement it fully. They'd like to run another initiative, a referendum, to overturn it.
It's expensive to reduce class sizes.
But what we've learned, whether you're Tim Iman or whether you're the teachers union, if the legislature doesn't like the law that the people passed, they'll find a way to make it symbolic.
Yeah, the teachers union, I think, has done what nobody else could, which is bring the House, the Senate, and the governor all together, because none of them want to fund 1351 because of the impact it causes on the budget. So, I mean, that's why I think that this is a problem. There's no question that we've got to increase spending on education, and both budgets do that significantly. And that's why I think that they're pushing their luck a little bit with this.
Again, Seattle teachers will be out of school on Tuesday, May 19th to protest what they say is the legislature shortchanging public education. It's just one of a series of rolling strikes. Granite Falls, Lake Stevens, Snohomish, Franklin Pier, Shoreline, Camas, Evergreen, Washougal, North Kitsap, Squim. I could go on. An estimated one quarter of the public school students in the state affected. You're listening to KUOW's Week in Review, and we're going to be right back running down the week's top stories. Stay tuned. KUOW's Week in Review. Thanks for joining us. You're joining Knute Berger, the Mossback at crosscut.com, Erica Barnett at the cisforcrank.com. She covers the City Beat. Todd Myers directs the Center for the Environment at the Free Market Washington Policy Center. And we are learning from the week's news. We're live tweeting the show, you know, at KUOW, and we're on Facebook at KUOW Public Radio. Are you a helicopter parent? Not sure how to back off and give your child space? Tomorrow is your day, Seattle. It is Take Our Children to the Park and Leave Them There Day, when parents and caregivers take their kids to the local park, or better yet, let the kid walk there. The adults will leave and the children will play, unsupervised. The idea of free-range parenting has made headlines ever since a Maryland couple was investigated for child neglect for letting their 6- and 10-year-old kids walk home a mile from a park. A concerned citizen saw the youngsters alone along a busy street and called the cops. Lots of parents rallied to their side. The media detected a movement, called it free-range parenting. Seattle's Q13 Fox profiled a Covington teenager named Gabby Schiuchetti, who's been riding trains and buses since she was 13 years old. And Gabby does not claim that she's completely out of danger.
There have been lots of scenarios where people have tried to talk to me on the train or talk to me on the bus that I'm not completely comfortable with. Part of the really great things about the way my parents raised me is that I'm self-sufficient enough to be like, okay, I'm uncomfortable, here's a way I can deal with this, or I could go talk to the bus driver, or move away, or switch buses.
The movement, the energy behind free-range parenting, if you will, is that modern parenting is hurting our children. Todd, is that true?
I kind of like this. I mean, when I was a kid, didn't have any problem riding my bike 3 miles to school and things like that. So I understand it.
Was everyone, by the way, this is, I feel like everybody, we're all middle-age-ish. I feel like everybody I know says the exact same. Sorry, Erica. Erica's in her 20s. But were you free range when you were a kid? Just like a quick, did everyone have that experience?
Yeah, generally.
Yes, free range.
Okay,
yeah.
We were all free range.
And for the record, I am not in my 20s. But
sorry.
Late 20s.
Is it true? Do you accept that we are overprotective now to the detriment of our children?
Well, I mentioned my sister's is a teacher, and I am shocked at the stories that she tells me of when kids get in trouble and the parents come in and yell at her, my sister, the teacher. I remember when I was a kid, if I got in trouble with the teacher, I was in trouble. And so I do think that there are parents who are overprotective and do these sorts of things to show, you know, how much they love them by being there constantly. And I think the kids, rather than figuring out how to be responsible for their actions, how to deal with difficult situations, rely on their parents, rely on outside, you know, people to come and save them. Does that mean that you should just let your kids, that you should announce the day that you are letting your kids go to the park unsupervised? I'm not sure I would announce it.
Yeah.
But as a general rule, I don't see any problem with this.
Because you mentioned that, on our Facebook page, Bo writes in and says, human traffickers are totally pumped for Saturday. And maybe Bo is engaging in dark humor there. But, I mean, that occurred to me too. Maybe that makes me a helicopter parent that I thought, oh, are we telling everybody that there's unsupervised kids in
parks? Yeah, but I think the general point I would agree with. I think we helicopter too much.
Okay.
It seems like the kind of symbolic gesture you would be against, Todd.
Mm. Oh, you let kids get into troubles with other kids and work themselves out. That seems very real to me and very human. I like it.
I think the abduction point, and I don't have kids. I don't believe that I would be a helicopter parent. I was definitely brought up, you know, you walk to school. My school was 3 miles away. No big deal. Go to the park. Back then we called it latchkey kids. I did not get abducted. Very few children do get abducted. I think the most recent number was like 100 something per year. And
that's the tension here, right? Between how scared we are and how safe we are.
Kids are much more likely to get hit by a car. So, you know, to me, that speaks to the need for safe routes to schools and, you know, making kids actually safe from the actual dangers that they face rather than this sort of, you know, chimera of child abduction, which is extremely rare.
But if your kid is unsupervised, isn't he or she more likely to run out in front of a car, too?
That is true. And
that's part of why we keep a close eye.
That's a sad commentary on the state of affairs now that we don't have safe routes for kids to get to school without, you know, the threat. I don't think they're running out in front of cars so much as it's more dangerous for kids now because our streets are all about cars and not about people.
And our cars don't make any noise.
Kids aren't going to learn to deal with risk unless they deal with a certain level of risk. That's just part of being alive. And I can tell you, I mean, my mother was, you know, pretty much of the philosophy that on a weekend after you've done your chores, you got shooed outdoors and weren't expected back until dinner or lunch. But basically, the world was, you know, your oyster. I was going down to the Pike Place Market by myself on the bus at age 10 or 11, and the Pike Place Market was a very different place, I could tell you. And I would shop for groceries for my mother down there at a very early age. I was using the bus on my own. I walked to school. I did all that stuff. And so I was given tons of lectures by my mother. Don't throw dirt bombs. You might put somebody's eye out. Don't jaywalk or don't play in the street. I mean, I had all kinds of rules that she put in my head that made me aware that, you know, I had friends that got hit by cars or broken arm or something, but that could happen in the playground at school too.
Yes, but once you're aware of that worst case scenario, how could a parent do anything else but keep their kid safe from that?
Well, they can chill. I mean, you know,
we're more aware of the danger.
Well,
and it's our job to act on what are the dangers we perceive, there's no God telling us that you are realistic or not realistic in your fears. We're more anxious today, but we're also more involved. We're more mindful. We're more empathetic. If I were a kid, I'd take me over my parents.
I do not think that we are necessarily more aware. I think the fact that everybody is afraid of child abductions when that's incredibly rare is testimony to the fact that we are not more aware. We're just more freaked out. And, you know, one point I was going to make that Knut mentioned briefly is, you know, this is mothers used to be able to shoo their kids out. Now mothers are extended. It is mostly mothers are expected to be by their kid's side all the time. And if anything goes wrong, if the kid climbs a tree and breaks their arm, it's the mother's fault. And this is really constraining on working women who feel the obligation to not just be in the workplace, but also to be almost full-time parents.
Yeah, you know, I was shocked a few years ago. I did an article about a wonderful summer camp that I went to as a kid that was having going through a troubled time. And one of the problems they were having was at this summer camp, you go for 2, 3, 5 weeks. It's an extended thing. You're camping in tents. You're doing lots of outdoor activities. And but they saw their attendance declining because the camp does not allow electronic devices of any kind. And one of the main objections that parents had was they couldn't call their children every day, or they couldn't monitor them on their laptop. I mean, we talk about a surveillance society. I mean, your parents are worse than the NSA. And I think it's way, way, way overboard.
I'm not yet convinced that our younger generation had turned out badly because of it. Everybody says, our parents let us play, and look how great we turned out. What's so great about us? I know a lot of miserable people my age. Miserable jerks.
I also know that it's not a bad thing to encourage your kids to get outside as opposed to sit inside and play video games, too.
And it gives a sense of independence. I mean, I think that's very important. You see kids, you know, going off to college, still sort of tethered to their parents. And that's really damaging when you're trying to become an adult and become a separate human being.
All right. I can hear my blades whirring. I think
your helicopter is on the pad taking off. Right, Bill?
I'm going to fly that helicopter to the park and just hover over all the free range kids this weekend. Again, it's tomorrow is take our children to the park and leave them their day. We'll leave it there and be back in a moment on KUOW's Week in Review with more of the week's top stories. Hey, KUOW's Week in Review is going to be popping up all around Seattle this summer to review the news in your neighborhood. Starting May 29th, we're going to be in West Seattle at the Youngstown Cultural Center. West Seattle, Youngstown Cultural Center, May 29th. We'd love to see you there. Find out all about it at KUOW.org. I'm Bill Radke with Knute Berger, Todd Myers, Erica Barnett, and the top stories of the week. Remember last year when a football star named Ray Rice got videotaped punching his fiancée unconscious in an elevator? The NFL went easy on him. There was a national outcry. The league vowed to get it right, launched a domestic violence awareness campaign. Seattle Seahawks coach Pete Carroll said the case left him a changed man.
The way you look at that when evaluating players going forward,
it will never be the same. I got to admit, my awareness is different than it was, and I don't think it'll ever be the same as it was. Hopefully, we can prevent, you know, maybe head off any kind of an issue that could come up in the future.
Well, the future is here. This week, the Seahawks' top draft pick is Michigan lineman Frank Clark, accused of punching his girlfriend. The Seahawks say they looked into it, and they're confident Clark did not hit her. But they never interviewed the witnesses who said they're sure he did. First of all, just briefly, does anyone here on our panel believe that Frank Clark didn't hit his girlfriend?
I don't know.
I don't believe it based on the descriptions in the stories.
I think it would be hard to believe based on the eyewitnesses.
Okay. This is, by the way, not just about sports. The Seahawks are a citywide passion and symbol. Seahawks fan Knute Berger, do you're agnostic about what happened in that hotel room. Do you want Seattle to be this man's second chance, even if he is guilty of domestic violence?
Well, he, you know, legally he wasn't guilty. I don't know what happened.
The charge was reduced, in fact, to disorderly
conduct. The prosecutor seems to feel that was appropriate. The Seahawks did look into it. How they did the investigation, I don't know. A lot of teams work at giving players second chances. The Seahawks have worked with lots of people that have come from really rough backgrounds. I would hope that this kid would, if at the very least, would get some counseling or something.
Did you see the welts on his girlfriend and the broken lamp?
I did not. Okay. No, I did not. But I think the controversy is good. I mean, this is something that is very much an important public discussion. People's awareness is evolving. It's good to have that in the public place. I've certainly been in courtrooms watching domestic abusers on the stand and understand.
Why not another team give them a second chance? Why do you care whether Seattle is the team that We've been talking about symbolism all this hour, right? Shell Oil, you know, not in our city, et cetera, et cetera. Do you want your home team to give Frank Clark a second?
Yeah, I don't think I would have picked him, you know, but the Seahawks have, and it'll be really interesting to see, you know, how this guy's life evolves and whether he, you know, improves as a person, assuming that that we can believe what happened, which.
I wouldn't say it would be interesting to see in the sense that this is some sort of public experiment to see if he beats up another woman. I think, and I do think this is ultimately about football. It's about Seattle, too, of course. But football, the NFL, has a long history of exonerating and excusing men who abuse and beat up women. And it's almost, I mean, it's part of the culture. And if they paid as much attention to abused women as they do to deflated footballs, imagine how different the NFL would be today.
So you don't want to see this guy in Seattle?
Absolutely not.
Let's see how a domestic violence professional feels about this. Peg Coleman at the Domestic Abuse Women's Network in Tukwila. Welcome to KUOW.
Thank you.
Peg, you've seen the police report. Do you believe the Seahawks that their top draft pick did not hit his girlfriend in that hotel room?
You know, I don't not believe it. I think there was obviously some kind of physical confrontation. And we have to remember that the legal definition of domestic violence, things get pled down. There's a legal definition which is very restrictive as opposed to what we know are tactics of an abusive relationship. So, none of us were there. It's not like the Ray Rice where we had the videotape recording of it. So I think the point on this is that he's already adjudicated, and he's already been. We're not the judge and jury on it, so I think it's hard. Had that come to me, I would have some doubts about whether it was a level of force that would go to the criminal intent on domestic violence, or whether there was abuse in the relationship. I think there's a problem there.
I'm surprised to hear you say that. I guess you're defying my expectations. Do you want Seattle to be Frank Clark's second chance?
Well, I think at this point we can't not allow it. So here's my problem. Is I've done batter intervention programs, and there's absolutely no, I think, any valid research on efficacy of these programs. So even if he goes to, and I believe he went to a court mandated program, the point is that he was adjudicated, and there is such a thing as restorative justice, which I think is much better than making this one person, punished because we're really trying to get the NFL to do things. I think we're getting very murky in this because it's not just the NFL that creates a culture of violence. It really is our predominant culture, and this is swept under the carpet. Unless somebody is on videotape, we don't take it seriously.
So are you saying that if we have a no second chance sort of moral outrage that we end up dividing the world into good guys and bad guys, and they're them, and we don't do that,
I think that's ridiculous. I mean, I think we're all capable. All of us are capable of tremendous compassion and good, but I think we're also capable of great harm. So I think when we do the us and them, the good, the bad, the hero, the demon, we're really creating a lot of confusion, and we're not really being accurate. We're not keeping ourselves accountable either. So I think I don't know what goes on behind anybody's closed door. So, and that's been my experience in working with both batterers and victims over the course of, 25, 30 years, is that you never really know. I've had men in my groups that that were extraordinarily polite and well-behaved and conscientious in class, and find out later that they were wailing on their family in a horrific way. But we don't know. And there's a lot of reasons why victims recant, and there's a lot of reasons why victims don't want to press charges. So it becomes very, very murky. With all this public attention, we're often going to be putting the victim on public display and tearing her apart, like we saw with Ray Rice's now wife. We start victim blaming and analyzing her behavior, and that's not where the focus should be. I think when we make the NFL the big power punch, no pun intended, on this message, we're ignoring the fact that this is an epidemic in our communities and that it goes on all the time across all socioeconomic classes and race. I've worked with doctors and lawyers, and it's everywhere.
Well, I find that fascinating. Peg Coleman, Domestic Abuse Women's Network in Tukwila. Thank you for sharing your thoughts about this.
Thank you.
So there, someone who's worked with, as you said, batterers and victims for 25 or 30 years saying, not so fast, let's not have a, keep them out of Seattle simplistic approach.
Yeah, and let me just add, I work for the Mariners and for the Sonics, and this issue comes up from time to time with teams where they get these bad actors. The challenge, I think, for the Seahawks is that you're asking them to second-guess the judicial system, as she said, which I think puts them in a tough position. But what I think we can expect of them is to demand better of him. You know, the Mariners with Jesus Montero, and he didn't do anything like this, but he was obviously in trouble with his family life and elsewhere, and they challenged him. They said, you got to turn things around. And he has. And that second chance has really resulted in something. That, I think, we can expect of the Seahawks.
We just have a minute left. I want to give you the last word, Erica, because I was a little surprised to hear Peg come at it a little differently from how you did.
I was a little surprised, too. Her take seemed very legalistic to me. I do think that the Seahawks have the right to say, we do not want this type of activity associated with our team, whether or not the justice system has said that technically he was only guilty of a lower crime. And so I think it is completely within the Seahawks' purview to say this is a problem. Yes, it's a problem societally, but hey, it's also a big problem in the NFL, and we're going to say something about it.
We've been talking about the Seattle Seahawks' top draft pick, accused, not even charged, much less convicted of domestic violence. Just one of the top stories of the week, and we're out of time with Erica Barnett from the C is for Crank, Todd Myers from the Washington Policy Center, Knut Berger at crosscut.com, the Mossback. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
This show is produced by Jason Pagano. We're on iTunes, Stitcher. You'll get the podcast. Go to our website, kuow.org.